You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Life Between Death and Rebirth, Lecture 4. In our previous studies of the life between death and rebirth, we saw that part of the human being, on passing through the portal of death, leaves the physical body and the greater part of the etheric body behind. This, the imperishable part of the human being, draws its forces from the starry realms between death and rebirth. We pointed out that a person has more or less power to draw his forces from the star world in the right way, according as he has developed certain moral or religious feelings during earthly life. We said that a person is able to draw the correct forces from what is occultly called the sphere of Mercury by acquiring a moral frame of mind during his life before death, and that from Venus he can draw the forces necessary for his further life, and also for his further life on earth by living a religious life before death. If we sum up the various thoughts with which we have so far dealt, we may say that as long as man uses his senses, as long as he is guided and led by the intellect, which is connected with the brain as its instrument, that is, during earthly life, he is bound up with the forces of this, our earth. So, also, in his life between death and rebirth, he is bound up with the forces which proceed from the star worlds. There is, however, a certain difference for present-day man between the relation of his being to the earth forces during physical life and his relation to the star forces between death and rebirth. The forces he experiences consciously during earthly life do not contribute essentially to all he has need of for the upbuilding and animation of his own being. We see that this is the case from the simple consideration that during sleep man has no consciousness. Why not? It is simply because he is not to witness what happens to him during sleep. For during sleep, the forces used up in waking life are restored, and he has not, during sleep, to witness this restoration. This entire process, which is the reverse of the process during the waking state, is veiled from human consciousness. The Bible makes an important and profound statement regarding this fact, and it is one of those statements which, like all the occult foundations of religious records, is but little understood. In the part dealing with the life of paradise, we are told that the divine spirit descended, that after man had gained the power to judge between good and evil, he was not to see the forces of life. That is the passage in the Bible which points out that man is not to witness the reanimation of his being during sleep, or during his physical earthly life at all. He is not to witness this. When man awakes, the whole of his life process is really a destructive process, a wearing out process. During waking life, nothing is really restored. In the case where there is still a true vivification, namely an earliest childhood, the consciousness is still dull, and the whole process of restoration is later veiled from man, because he no longer remembers the time of his early childhood. Hence we may say that what may be called the processes of reanimation or restoration are veiled from the conscious earthly life of man. Processes of perception and knowledge fill his consciousness, but these are not true animating processes. This is different in the life between death and rebirth. The purpose of the whole life between death and rebirth is to absorb into the human being the forces which may serve to construct the next life, to absorb them from all the world of the stars. But in this process, it is not as on the earth, where man does not know himself at all. What does a person know of the processes going on in his organism? He knows nothing about them from direct vision. And that which is gained by means of anatomy, biology, etc., is not really knowledge of the human being. It is something quite different. But in the life between death and rebirth, man observes how the forces from the star world work upon his being, and how they gradually rebuild it. From this you may gather how different is the outlook between death and rebirth from what it is here upon the earth. Here man stands at some point on the earth, and directs his senses outward, his sight or hearing sweeps out into space. And from the center at which he stands, he looks forth into space. In the life after death, it is exactly the reverse. He then feels as if his whole being were spread abroad, and what he looks at is really the center. He is looking toward a point. A time comes between death and rebirth when man describes a circle which passes through the whole zodiac. He then regards his own being from every part of the zodiac, that is, from various standpoints, and feels as if he were gathering from the various parts of the zodiac forces which he pours into his being, so that this may have what it needs for the next incarnation. He looks from the circumference toward the center. It is as if here on earth you were to duplicate yourself, to step forth and leave yourself in the center, then go round yourself, absorbing continually the forces of the universe, the vivifying soma. As this acquires a different character from the various quarters, it pours in different ways into the being you have left in the center. This, translated into what is spiritual, is actually what takes place in a life between death and rebirth. Now, if we wish to distinguish the difference between a condition which is very similar to the experience between death and rebirth, namely, that between sleep and life between death and rebirth, we may characterize it very simply, although those who are unaccustomed to such ideas will not be able to realize it very well. We may, however, characterize it in the following manner. When a person falls asleep during his earthly life, that is to say, when he has left his physical and etheric bodies and is living in his ego and astral body, which are then in the star world, he also is outside them in the whole starry realm. Our state during sleep is objectively much more like the state between death and rebirth than is usually thought. Objectively, these two conditions are very similar. The only difference is that in normal life, a person is unconscious of the world in which he is during sleep, whereas between death and rebirth, he is conscious and knows what is happening to him. This is the essential difference. If a person were simply to wake up in his ego and astral body, when, during sleep, these are outside the physical and etheric bodies, he would be in the same state in which he is between death and rebirth. The difference is really only one of consciousness, and this circumstance is very important for the reason given above. It is important because as long as man dwells on earth, he is bound to his physical body. He is not free from it, even during sleep. He only becomes free from it when it passes into the lifeless condition, when it undergoes a change, such as takes place when man passes through the portal of death. As long as the physical body is alive, union is maintained between the true spiritual man, the ego and astral body, and the physical body and the etheric body. Now, the condition of sleep is usually thought of in too simple a manner. This is quite comprehensible, because in view of the complicated things connected with the moment of our entrance into the higher worlds, we can only characterize these things from a certain aspect. And we only acquire a complete description of the true conditions when we gradually progress patiently in spiritual science and learn these things from every side. We describe the condition of human sleep correctly by saying that the physical and etheric bodies remain lying on the couch, and what we call the ego and astral body move out and unite with the star forces. But this description, correct as it is only given from one aspect. We may form an idea of how this description is given from one aspect only, if we consider human sleep from the standpoint of spiritual science, when this sleep takes place at the normal time. For, considered objectively, a little afternoon nap is quite different from regular sleep in the night. This does not come into much consideration in respect to health or other conditions in man himself. What I have just said applies to the whole relation of man to the world. Therefore, we shall not now consider an afternoon nap, but the sleep of a healthy person at about midnight from the standpoint of clairvoyant consciousness. When we are awake during the day, the four principles of human nature, the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I, are in a certain orderly connection within the human being. And we picture the union, the proper union, between the four principles of human nature in the best way, if we draw it in somewhat the manner in which clairvoyant consciousness sees the so-called human aura. What I have drawn here is, of course, quite sketchy. There's a picture. If we consider the ordinary waking state of man, we should draw what is in the aura in this way. On the left, the more distinct shape represents the physical body. Within the dotted line, the etheric body. The lined part is the astral body, and the eye aura would have to be drawn in such a way that it is seen permeating the whole man. But I draw it as rays surrounding him above and below, without any actual limits. Next to it, I now draw the difference in the aura of a person who is asleep about midnight. Physical body and etheric body, as in the first drawing, the darkly lined part would be the astral body, whose indefinite continuation below would be lifted out, but would still remain in a vertical position. I then draw the eye aura in the shape of rays, as you see here. The eye aura is interrupted in the region of the throat, and only begins again in the region of the head, but in such a way that it is directed outward in the form of rays and passes into the indefinite above when the person is in the horizontal position, but it is directed upward from the head. So that, essentially, the picture of the aura of a human being who is asleep would be that the astral body is really denser and darker in the region darkly lined in the drawing, and in the upper part it is thinner than during the day. In the region of the throat, the eye aura is interrupted. Down below it is again in the form of rays and then passes on into the indefinite. The essential thing is that in a sleep such as we have described, what we may call the auric picture of the ego or I actually divides into two parts. Whereas, while awake, the eye aura is like an oval, during sleep it divides in the middle and then consists of two parts, one of which is turned downward by a sort of gravity and spreads out so that it is not closed below, but is outspreading. To clairvoyant consciousness, this part of the eye aura appears on the whole as a very dark part of the aura, with dark threads, and is strongly tinged with dark red shades. The upper portion of the eye aura is smaller. It streams forth from the region of the head and spreads out indefinitely into the star world. The astral aura is not divided in the middle in this way, so that we cannot speak of an actual division, whereas the eye aura is divided. At least it appears so. We have here tried to represent pictorially what is seen in occult vision, how with the eye forces which fill him while he is awake, man goes forth into space and unites himself with the world of the stars in order to absorb its forces. Now the lower portion of the eye aura, which spreads out below, becoming dark and more or less opaque, whereas the part streaming forth above is shining and sparkling, raying forth in bright light, is the one which is most exposed to the influences of the Ahrimanic powers. The portion of the astral aura touching upon this is most exposed to the Luciferic forces. Therefore we may say that the description which says that the eye and astral body leave man is correct from a certain standpoint, and applies exactly to the upper parts of the eye and astral aura. But it is not really correct for those parts of the eye and astral aura which correspond to the lower parts of man, especially the lower parts of the torso. As regards these parts, it is even the case that during sleep the aura of the eye and astral body are more within, more closely united to the physical and etheric bodies than when the man is awake. They are denser and more compact below. One also sees that what I have lined so strongly goes out again from the lower parts of the human being on waking, just as on going to sleep the upper portion of the eye and astral aura goes forth. So on waking the lower portion goes forth in a certain way, and only a part of these two auras remains within, as I have drawn it in the first diagram. Now it is also extremely important to know that through the evolution of our earth, through all the forces which have participated in this, as stated in occult science, it was ordained that man should not participate in this greater activity of the lower aura during sleep. That is to say, he was not to be there consciously as a witness. For the vivifying forces which man needs for the restoration of what has been used up during his waking state are stimulated by these parts of the lower eye aura and the lower astral aura. The restorative forces have to proceed from these parts of the aura. The circumstance that they work upward and restore the entire man depends upon the upper aura developing forces of attraction which it draws from the star world, and on its being thereby able to attract the forces coming from below, so that they may rejuvenate man. That is the objective process. The understanding of this fact enables us to comprehend certain things we find in various occult records, or in works based on occultism. You have always heard, and the statement is quite justified from a certain standpoint, that sleep consists in man leaving his physical and etheric bodies on the couch and going forth with his ego and astral body. This is quite correct as regards the upper portions of the eye and astral auras, especially the eye aura. If you read Oriental writings, you do not find this characteristic, but exactly the reverse. There you find it described, how during sleep that which usually dwells in human consciousness sinks more deeply into the body. In certain parts of the Vedanta in particular, you will find the matter so characterized that this, of which we say that it goes forth from the physical and etheric bodies, sinks more deeply into the physical and etheric bodies, and that what ordinarily produces sight withdraws into the deeper parts of the eyes, so that sight cannot be realized. Why is it described in this manner in Oriental writings? It is because the Oriental sees it from a different standpoint. Through his kind of clairvoyance, he sees more that which goes on in the inner being of man. He pays less attention to the process of the going forth of the upper aura, and more to the fact of the permeation with the lower aura during sleep. From this standpoint, he is quite right. The processes which have taken place in man in the course of his evolution are very complicated, and it will become possible as time goes on to realize more and more the extent of these processes. Evolution has taken place in such a way that humanity has gradually learned the various parts which come into view. Hence the variety in the teachings which have been given out in various ages. Although apparently these do not sound the same, they are not on that account wrong, but relate to the one aspect with which they deal. The entire process of evolution will only be clear when we combine all the several aspects. This is the essential thing. We are now at a stage when a certain part of evolution may be surveyed extremely well. There is a great difference in our outlook, in our whole frame of mind, when we observe, for example, the development of the human soul in the incarnations which took place in the Chaldaic Egyptian age, or the Greco-Latin age, and then again in our own. Even in an external manner, we can trace quite well what the soul experienced. It is possible that even in this enlightened circle, there may be quite a number who, when they look up at the star-strewn heavens, do not know exactly where the various constellations are, and how they change their positions in space during the night. In general, we may say that the number of those who possess accurate knowledge of the heavens is growing less and less. There may even be people in town from whom we might ask in vain, "Is it now full moon or new moon?" That is by no means intended to be a reproach. It belongs to the natural course of evolution. But what holds good for the soul now would have been quite impossible in the Egypto-Chaldean age, especially in the early part of it, for people then possessed knowledge of the heavens. The character of the present age is quite different from that of the Egypto-Chaldean age. The people of that age never even thought of thinking logically, in the way people think today if they take the trouble. What the Egyptians did in their daily affairs, they did more instinctively. It would be quite erroneous to think that a building or a canal was constructed in such a manner that the engineers first sat together in their offices and drew up plans, etc., as we do now. The Egyptians did not do this, any more than beavers draw up plans according to rule for the construction of their buildings. There was no logical scientific thought such as we now possess. What they did while awake, they did instinctively. They gained what they knew, and we know that very great knowledge has come down from the Egypto-Chaldean age in quite a different way. They knew the starry heavens. They were well acquainted with the stars. But they had no astronomy such as we possess. They observed the heavens and the different positions of the constellations at different times during the night, and they were affected not only by that which made an impression on the senses, not merely by that which is perceived by the senses, but by all the astral forces in space. They experienced these. Thus, for example, the path of the Great Bear, or the Pleiades, was an experience, one which continued when they were asleep, for they were sensitive to what passed through the heavens spiritually with the Great Bear. All this they received, and along with what the senses perceived, they received what was spiritual in space. Something came into their consciousness which the present consciousness of man is incapable of receiving. For now, man only perceives the sensible picture of the firmament, and, as he is very clever, he takes the celestial chart on which the ancients drew the various animal forms and says, quote, "Formerly, people drew symbols. That was the way they thought of the stars. But man has now progressed so far that he can see the reality as it is." Close quote. The man of the present day, however, does not know that the ancients also saw what they sketched, that they drew real structures according to what they saw directly in front of them. One could draw better, another worse, but they drew reality, they saw it. They did not, however, see as we see in sense life. But when, for example, they perceived the Great Bear as it passed across the sky at night, they saw the physical stars embedded in a mighty spiritual being, which they really perceived. It was not as if they saw an animal pass over that part of the sky as we see a physical animal on the earth. That would be a childish idea. The experience of the passage of the Pleiades over the sky was connected inwardly with their own nature. They felt how it acted upon their astral body and produced changes in it. You may form an idea of the condition in the following way. Here is a rose. Suppose you do not see it, but merely grasp it, and by grasping it realize your contact with it. Thus you do not see the rose. You only grasp it and feel your own contact with it, and in this way form an idea of the rose. It was in this way the Egyptians and Chaldeans touched, as it were, with their astral body, what they experienced in the Great Bear. They felt the astral quality and experienced their own contact with it. and this produced changes within them, changes which are still produced today, but are no longer perceived. Evolution into our modern scientific age, our age of the power of judgment, has consisted in the ceasing of direct experience of spiritual processes. And in the sense world, and the intellect, connected with the brain, being left. When, therefore, in the Egypto-Chaldean age, they spoke of the spiritual beings in space, and drew them, drawing also in them, like supports, the physical stars, this was in accordance with the reality which they directly experienced. So that in the Egypto-Chaldean age, people had a perception which was much more like the life between death and rebirth than the conscious life we have at present. When it is really perceived that the astral body and ego participate in the processes of the heavens, it is also known. When you are living in the starry sky, you are living outside your physical and etheric bodies. And there is not the slightest reason that when you have these no longer, you should not continue to live in the firmament. In the Egypto-Chaldean age, people had direct knowledge of their connection with the star world between death and rebirth. An inhabitant of the earth in that age would have considered it ridiculous if someone wished to prove to him the immortality of the soul, for he would have said, quote, "There is no need to prove that," close quote. He would not even have understood what a proof is, in our sense, because he did not possess logical thought. And if he had learned in an occult school what a proof would be in the future, he would have said, quote, "There is no need to prove the immortality of the soul, because when at night I feel myself in the firmament of stars, I experience that which is independent of the body," close quote. To him, immortality was a direct experience. The Egyptians knew from experience in the discarnate condition a great deal of what we now describe regarding perception. They knew all this directly. Passing from the more distant firmament to the planets belonging to our solar system, Saturn, for example, was something that they perceived spiritually. That is to say, they perceived what is connected with Saturn spiritually. They actually perceived what is experienced by man on Saturn between death and rebirth. This applies more particularly to the early part of the Egypto-Chaldean age. It would have seemed extremely curious to a man of that age if we had said to him that we should endeavor to find what corresponds to Mars in the way we now think of it, for he was consciously connected with these worlds. When, however, we know Saturn or Mars or any other planetary condition and can trace how it is now expressed in our planetary system, this also leads us to the knowledge of the pre-earthly conditions described in occult science as the Saturn, Sun, and Moon conditions. This was experienced in that age. It would not have been necessary to lecture about it, but we should simply have brought it to their notice, so that those who could no longer perceive it directly would have been brought into conditions in which they could perceive it. It would not have been possible otherwise. The case was different in the Greco-Latin age. Human susceptibility to all I have just mentioned had already been lost, and only the memory of it remained. It was no longer possible for a soul born into the Greco-Latin civilization to see what was spiritual in the star worlds. It could no longer see the spiritual beings which belonged to the stars to the same extent as in the Egypto-Chaldean age. But just as a person now remembers what he experienced yesterday, the souls then remembered what they had experienced regarding the universe in former incarnations. This streamed into them. They knew that it was in their souls. Plato described it as memory, but people did not always describe it as memory. Progress in evolution consisted in this direct perception being suppressed, and in its place was developed the power of judgment and the world of ideas, which first appeared in the Greco-Latin age. The other had to withdraw, It could only live on in the memory. We can see this most clearly in Aristotle, who lived in the 4th century BC and was the founder of logic, the art of judging. He himself would not perceive the spiritual in the firmament, but in his works he recounts all the ancient theories, so that he does not speak of physical planets as we now do, but he speaks of the, quote, spirits of the spheres, close quote, of spiritual beings. And a great part of what he says is devoted to the enumeration of the various planetary spirits, the spirits of the fixed stars, etc., up to the one God of the universe. In Aristotle's works, the sphere spirits play a great role. Humanity gradually lost the remembrance of the spiritual beings which it possessed in the Greco-Latin age. And it is interesting to notice how the ancient knowledge was gradually lost after the dawn of modern times. The more spiritually inclined souls still drew forth from their memories the consciousness that spiritual beings are connected with the physical planets moving in space, just as we now represent the matter in spiritual science. We find in this connection that a great deal was magnificently presented to his age by Kepler, but the nearer we come to modern times, the more we find that the possibility of remembering what the soul experienced when it gazed upon the firmament in the Egypto-Chaldean age has disappeared. The remembrance which still existed in the Greco-Latin age was also lost, and the age of the science of Copernicus approached, when humanity saw only physical globes whirling through space. Only occasionally, as we have said, by means of something piercing through into the consciousness, was it possible for more modern minds to trace spiritual things and spiritual processes from the constellations of stars. For instance, Kepler was interested in calculating from the stars the time of the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. That calculation was made because Kepler was still filled with the feeling of the spiritual. Kepler also understood quite clearly that the suppression of the ancient memory came from a certain constellation of stars in the year 1604. As we approach modern times, we find that humanity relies more and more upon the outer senses and the intellect connected with the brain, because what souls had experienced in ancient times had sunk into deeper layers of consciousness. In the souls of all men dwells that which was once experienced by them when they were able to perceive the living spiritual life in space. It is all there in the depths of their souls. But it is not possible now to lead souls at night and turn their gaze to the Great Bear, for example, and enable them to see the spiritual forces proceeding from it. This is not directly possible, because the necessary powers of vision and perception are deep down in the soul. During sleep at night, man experiences it with the upward-going part of the aura, but he does not experience it consciously. And for this reason, the bringing forth of the forgotten impressions of ancient times is a proper endeavor for the souls of the present day. How does this come about? In the way we do it in anthroposophy. Nothing new is presented to the souls of men, but what they experienced in former times is brought forth. What was not yet forgotten, but was no longer perceived in the Greco-Latin age, has now been completely forgotten, but it can be brought forth again. And anthroposophy is the stimulus for the bringing forth of knowledge forces which lie deep down in the soul. All those who have gone through evolution as far as the Western age have conceptions in the depths of their souls which can be roused by anthroposophy. And the methods of anthroposophy are the means for rousing these deeply hidden ideas. Let us now see the different ways in which the world was considered by a soul incarnated in the Greco-Latin age, and one incarnated at present. We have seen that in the Egypto-Chaldean age, even during earthly life, the soul was able to perceive, and in a certain way was connected with what it experienced between death and rebirth. This had not yet withdrawn so deeply into the soul. Hence the difference in consciousness upon the earth, and between death and rebirth, was not so great as it is now. The Greeks could only remember what they had experienced. Therefore the difference in consciousness was already great. Now the matter has gone so far that between death and rebirth, man can still develop a consciousness through a moral frame of mind and a religious attitude as far as to the Venus sphere. But when he comes into the Sun sphere, and especially beyond it, it is impossible for him to enkindle his consciousness if here upon the earth he does not set about drawing forth into his ordinary consciousness the conceptions which lie deep down in his soul. Here in earthly life, anthroposophy seems like a theory, a view of the world which we take up because it interests us. After death it is a torch which illumines the spiritual world for us after a certain stage has been reached between death and rebirth. If a person despises it here in the world, then between death and rebirth he will lack this torch, and a fading of consciousness will ensue. To take up spiritual science is not merely something theoretical. It is a living thing. Spiritual science is as a life torch. Here the contents of spiritual teachings are conceptions and ideas. After death, they are living forces. This really only applies to our consciousness, however. For, from what I told you at the beginning of this lecture, you will understand that the spiritual ideas we acquire are invigorating forces during earthly life also. Man is not a witness of the invigorating forces, because the knowledge of these animating powers is withheld from him, but after death he sees them, he witnesses them. Here, anthroposophy is a sort of theory, and that which gives life spiritually and which exists objectively is hidden from man's consciousness while he is awake. But after death he sees directly how the forces he assimilated with spiritual teachings during his life on earth actually act in an organizing, animating, invigorating manner upon that part of his being which is present when he again descends to a new incarnation on the earth. Thus, spiritual teaching is received into the evolution of humanity. If this spiritual teaching is not received, at present it is sufficient if a few accept it, but as time goes on it must be taken up more and more. People, when they return again to earthly incarnations, will gradually not have enough of the life-giving forces which they will then require. A decadence, a degeneration, would in that case come about in later incarnations. People would soon become wrinkled and withered. If spiritual forces are not assimilated, a decadence of physical humanity will set in, for the forces which humanity formerly received from the star worlds must be drawn forth again from the depths of the souls and used for the evolution of the whole of humanity. If you reflect upon what has been said, you will be filled with thoughts of the immense importance of the life on earth. It was necessary that man should become shut off within himself and separated from his union with the star worlds, in order that the same power which he ordinarily absorbed from these worlds should become the innermost force of his soul and be drawn forth again from his soul. This can only happen, however, on the earth. We might express it by saying that in ancient times the soma juice rained down from heaven into individual souls, was preserved there, and is now to flow forth again from these individual souls. In this way we gain, in quite a special manner, an idea of the mission of the earth, and having presented this conception, we shall go further into details of the life between death and rebirth when next we continue these studies. The end of Lecture 4.